swallowed, and shook her head, limp, barely alive.
That's why the cancer came back. I know it. People can only bear so much pain.
Her voice was becoming more slurred. He wondered how much Valium she had already taken as she closed her eyes drowsily.
Yvette, would it be all right if I used your bathroom? He asked.
She assented with a sleepy nod. Strike got up and moved quickly and surprisingly quietly for a man of his bulk into the walk-in wardrobe. The space was lined with mahogany doors that reached to the ceiling. Strike opened one of the doors and glanced inside, at overstuffed railings of dresses and coats, with a shelf of bags and hats above, breathing in the musty smell of old shoes and fabric, which, in spite of the evident costliness of the contents, evoked an old charity shop. Silently, he opened and closed door after door, until on the fourth attempt, he saw a cluster of clearly brand new handbags, each of a different colour, that had been squeezed onto the high shelf. He took down the blue one, shot new and shiny. Here was the GS logo and the silk lining that was zipped into the bag. He ran his fingers around it, into every corner, then replaced it deftly on the shelf. He selected the white bag next. The lining was patterned with a stylized African print. Again he ran his fingers all around the interior. Then he unzipped the lining. It came out, just as Chiara had described, like a metal-edged scarf, exposing the rough interior of the white leather. Nothing was visible inside until he looked more closely. And then he saw the line of pale blue, running down the side of the stiff rectangular cloth-covered board holding the base of the bag in shape. He lifted up the board and saw, beneath it, a folded piece of pale blue paper, scribbled all over in an untidy hand. Strike replaced the bag swiftly on the shelf with the lining bundled inside, and took from an inside pocket of his jacket a clear plastic bag, into which he inserted the pale blue paper, shaken open but unread. He closed the mahogany door and continued to open others. Behind the penultimate door was a safe, operated by a digital keypad. Strike took a second plastic bag from inside his jacket, slid it over his hand, and began to press keys. But before he had completed his trial, he heard movement outside. Hastily thrusting the crumpled bag back into a pocket, he closed the wardrobe door as quietly as possible and walked back into the bedroom to find the Macmillan nurse bending over Yvette Bristow. She looked around when she heard him.
"Wrong door," said Strike. "I thought it was the bathroom."
He went into the small ensuite, and here, with the door closed, before flushing the toilet and turning on the taps for the nurse's benefit, he read the last will and testament of Lula Landry, scribbled on her mother's writing paper, and witnessed by Rochelle Onifade. Yvette Bristow was still lying with her eyes closed when he returned to the bedroom.
"She's asleep," said the nurse gently. "She does this a lot."
"Yes," said Strike,
the blood pounding in his ears.
"Please tell her I said goodbye when she wakes up. I'm going to have to leave now."
They walked together down the comfortable passageway.
"Lady Bristow seems very ill," Strike commented.
"Oh, yes, she is," said the nurse. "She could die any time now. She's very poorly."
"I think I might have left my..."
said Strike vaguely, wandering left into the yellow sitting room he had first visited, leaning over the sofa to block the nurse's view, and carefully replacing the telephone receiver he had taken off the hook.
"Yes, here it is," he said,
pretending to palm something small and put it in his pocket.
"Well, thanks very much for the coffee."
With his hand on the door, he turned to look at her.
"Her Valium addiction's as bad as ever, then," he said.
Unsuspicious, trusting, the nurse smiled a tolerant smile.
"Yes, it is. But it can't hurt her now. Mind you," she said, "I'd give those doctors a piece of my mind. She's had three of them giving her prescriptions for years, from the labels on the boxes."
Very unprofessional, said Strike. Thanks again for the coffee. Goodbye. He jogged down the stairs, his mobile already out of his pocket, so exhilarated that he did not concentrate on where he was going, so that he took a corner on the stair and let out a bellow of pain as the prosthetic foot slipped on the edge. His knee twisted and he fell, hard and heavy, down 6 stairs, landing in a heap at the bottom, with an excruciating fiery pain in both the joint and the end of his stump, as though it was freshly severed, as though the scar tissue was still healing.
Fuck! Fuck!
Are you all right? Shouted the Macmillan nurse, gazing down at him over the banisters, her face comically inverted.
I'm fine! Fine! He shouted back. Slipped! Don't worry!
Fuck! Fuck! Fuck!
He moaned under his breath, as he pulled himself back to his feet on the newel post, scared to put his full weight on the prosthesis. He limped downstairs, leaning on the banisters as much as possible, half hopped across the lobby floor, and hung on to the heavy front door as he manoeuvred himself out onto the front steps. The sporting children were receding in a distant crocodile, pale and navy blue, winding their way back to their school and lunch. Strike stood leaning against warm brick, cursing himself fluently and wondering what damage he had done. The pain was excruciating, and the skin that had already been irritated felt as though it had been torn. It burned beneath the gel pad that was supposed to protect it, and the idea of walking all the way to the underground was miserably unappealing. He sat down on the top step and phoned a taxi, after which he made a further series of calls, firstly to Robin, then to Wardle, then to the offices of Landry, May, Patterson. The black cab swung around the corner. For the very first time, it occurred to Strike how like miniature hearses they were, these stately black vehicles, as he hoisted himself upright and limped in escalating pain down to the pavement. Part 5 Felix qui portuit rerum cognoscere causas. Lucky is he who has been able to understand the causes of things. Virgil, Georgics, Book 2. Chapter 1 I'd have thought, said Eric Wardle slowly, looking down at the will in its plastic pocket, you'd have wanted to show this to your client first.
I would, but he's in Rye, said Strike. And this is urgent. I've told you I'm trying to prevent 2 more murders. We're dealing with a maniac here, Wardle.
He was sweating with pain. Even as he sat here, in the sunlit window of the Feathers, urging the policeman to action, Strike was wondering whether he might have dislocated his knee or fractured the small amount of tibia left to him in the fall down Yvette Brewster's stairwell. He had not wanted to start fiddling with his leg in the taxi, which was now waiting for him at the curb outside. The meter was eating steadily away at the advance Bristow had paid him, of which he would never receive another instalment, for today would see an arrest, if only Wardle would rouse himself.
I'll grant you this might show motive.
Might, repeated Strike, might. 10 million might constitute a motive, for fucks. But I need evidence that will stand up in court, and you haven't bought me any of that. I've just told you where you can find it. Have I been wrong yet? I told you it was a fucking will, and there,
Strike jabbed the plastic sleeve,
it fucking is. Get a warrant.
Wardle rubbed the side of his handsome face, as though he had toothache, frowning at the will.
Jesus Christ, said Strike. How many more times? Tansy Bastigui was on the balcony. She heard Landry say, I've already done it.
You put yourself on very thin ice there, mate, said Wardle. Defence makes mincemeat of lying to suspects. When Bastigui finds out there aren't any photos, he's going to deny everything.
Let him. She won't. She's ripe to tell anyway. But if you're too much of a pussy to do anything about this, Wardle, said Strike, who could feel cold sweat on his back and a fiery pain in what remained of his right leg, and anyone else who was close to Landry turns up dead, I'm going to go straight to the fucking press. I'll tell him I gave you every bit of information I had, and that you had every fucking chance to bring this killer in. I'll make up my fee in selling the rights to my story, and you can pass that message on to Carver for me. Here, he said, pushing across the table a piece of torn paper, on which he had scribbled several six-figure numbers. Try them first. Now get a fucking warrant. He pushed the will across the table to Wardle, and slid off the high barstool. The walk from the pub to the taxi was agony. The more pressure he put on his right leg, the more excruciating the pain became. Robin had been calling Strike every 10 minutes since 1 o'clock, but he had not picked up. She rang again as he was climbing, with enormous difficulty, up the metal stairs towards the office, heaving himself up with the use of his arms. She heard his ringtone echoing up the stairwell, and hurried out onto the top landing.
There you are! I've been calling and calling, there's been loads... What's the matter? Are you all right?
I'm fine, he lied.
No, you... What's happened to you?
She hastened down the stairs towards him. He was white and sweaty, and looked, in Robin's opinion, as though he might be sick.
Have you been drinking?
No, I haven't been bloody drinking, he snapped. I've...
Sorry, Robin. In a bit of pain here. I just need to sit down. What's happened? Let me... I've got it. No problem. I can manage.
Slowly, he pulled himself to the top landing and limped very heavily to the old sofa. When he dropped his weight into it, Robin thought she heard something deep in the structure crack and noted, "We'll need a new one." And then, "But I'm leaving."
"What happened?"
she asked.
"I fell down some stairs," said Strike, panting a little, still wearing his coat. "Like a complete tit."
"What stairs? What happened?"
From the depths of his agony he grinned at her expression, which was part horrified, part excited.
"I wasn't wrestling anyone, Robin, I just slipped."
"Oh, I see. You're a bit... You look a bit pale. You don't think you could have done something serious, do you? I could get a cab. Maybe you should see a doctor."
"No need for that. Have we still got any of those painkillers lying around?"
She bought him water and paracetamol. He took them, then stretched out his legs, flinched and asked,
"What's been going on here? Did Graham Hardacre send you a picture?"
"Yes,"
she said, hurrying to her computer monitor.
"Here."
With a shunt of her mouse and a click, the picture of Lieutenant Jonah Aguman filled the monitor. In silence, they contemplated the face of a young man whose irrefutable handsomeness was not diminished by the overlarge ears he had inherited from his father. The scarlet, black and gold uniform suited him. His grin was slightly lopsided, his cheekbones high, his jaw square, and his skin dark with an undertone of red, like freshly brewed tea. He conveyed the careless charm that Lula Landry had had too, the indefinable quality that made the viewer linger over her image.
"He looks like her," said Robin in a hushed voice.
"Yeah, he does. Anything else been going on?"
Robin seemed to snap back to attention.
"Oh, God, yes. John Bristow called half an hour ago to say he couldn't get hold of you, and Tony Landry's called 3 times.
"I thought he might. What did he say?"
"He was absolutely... Well, the first time he asked to speak to you, and when I said you weren't here, he hung up before I could give him your mobile number. The second time he told me you had to call him straight away, but slammed down the phone before I could tell him you still weren't back. By the third time he was just, well, he was incredibly angry, screaming at me."
"He'd better not have been offensive," said Strike, scowling.
"He wasn't really. Well, not to me. It was all about you."
"What did he say?"
"He didn't make a lot of sense, but he called John Bristow a stupid prick, and then he was bawling something about Alison walking out, which he seemed to think had something to do with you, because he was yelling about suing you and defamation and all kinds of things."
"Alison's left her job?"
"Yes."
"Did he say where she..."
"No, of course he didn't. Why would he know?" he finished, more to himself than to Robin. He looked down at his wrist. His cheap watch seemed to have hit something when he had fallen downstairs, because it had stopped at 1:15.
"What's the time?"
10 to 5.
Already?
Yes. Do you need anything? I can hang around a bit.
No, I want you out of here.
His tone was such that instead of going to fetch her coat and handbag, Robin remained exactly where she was. What are you expecting to happen?
Strike was busy fiddling with his leg just below the knee. Nothing. You've just worked a lot of overtime lately. I'll bet Matthew will be glad to see you back early for once. There was no adjusting the prosthesis through his trouser leg.
Please, Robin, go, he said, looking up.
She hesitated, then went to fetch her trench coat and bag.
Thanks, he said. See you tomorrow.
She left. He waited for the sound of her footsteps on the stairs before rolling up his trouser leg, but heard nothing. The glass door opened, and she reappeared.
You're expecting someone to come, she said, clutching the edge of the door, aren't you?
Maybe, said Strike, but it doesn't matter. He mustered a smile at her tight, anxious expression. Don't worry about me. When her expression did not change, he added, I boxed a bit in the army, you know?
Robin half laughed.
Yes, you mentioned that.
Did I?
Repeatedly. That night, you know.
All right. Well, it's true.
But who are you?
Matthew wouldn't thank me for telling you. Go home, Robin. I'll see you tomorrow.
And this time, albeit reluctantly, she left.
He waited until he heard the door onto Denmark Street bang shut, then rolled up his trouser leg, detached the prosthesis, and examined his swollen knee and the end of his leg, which was inflamed and bruised. He wondered exactly what he had done to himself, but there was no time to take the problem to an expert tonight. He half wished now that he had asked Robin to fetch him something to eat before she left. Clumsily, hopping from spot to spot, holding onto the desk, the top of the filing cabinet, and the arm of the sofa to balance, he managed to make himself a cup of tea. He drank it sitting in Robin's chair, and ate half a packet of digestives, spending most of the time in contemplation of the face of Jonah Aguman. The paracetamol had barely touched the pain in his leg. When he had finished all the biscuits, he checked his mobile. There were many missed calls from Robin, and two from John Bristow. Of the three people who Strike thought might present themselves at his office this evening, it was Bristow he hoped would make it there first. If the police wanted concrete evidence of murder, his client alone, though he might not realise it, could provide it. If either Tony Landry or Alison Creswell turned up at his offices, I'll just have to... Then Strike snorted a little in his empty office, because the expression that had occurred to him was, think on my feet. But 6 o'clock came, and then half past, and nobody rang the bell. Strike rubbed more cream into the end of his leg, and reattached the prosthesis, which was agony. He limped through into the inner office, emitting grunts of pain, slumped down in his chair, and, giving up, took the false leg off again, and slid down, to lay his head on his arms, intending to do no more than rest his tired eyes.
Chapter 2 Footsteps on the metal stairs. Strike sat bolt upright, not knowing whether he had been asleep 5 minutes or 50. Somebody rapped on the glass door.
Come in, it's open, he shouted,
and checked that the unattached prosthesis was covered by his trouser leg. To Strike's immense relief, it was John Bristow who entered the room, blinking through his thick-lensed glasses and looking agitated.
Hi, John. Come and sit down.
But Bristow strode towards him, blotchy-faced, as full of rage as he had been the day that Strike had refused to take the case, and gripped the back of the offered chair instead.
I told you, he said,
the colour waxing and waning in his thin face as he pointed a bony finger at Strike.
I told you quite clearly that I didn't want you to see my mother without me present.
I know you did, John, but
she's unbelievably upset. I don't know what you said to her, but I've had her crying and sobbing down the phone to me this afternoon.
I'm sorry to hear that.
She didn't seem to mind my questions when...
She's in a dreadful state!" shouted Bristow, his buck teeth glinting. "How dared you go and see her without me? How dared you?"
"Because, John, as I told you after Rochelle's funeral, I think we're dealing with a murderer who might kill again," said Strike. "The situation's dangerous, and I want an end to it."
"You want an end to it? How do you think I feel?"
shouted Bristow, and his voice cracked and became a falsetto.
"Do you have any idea how much damage you've done? My mother's devastated, and now my girlfriend seems to have vanished into thin air, which Tony is blaming on you. What have you done to Alison? Where is she?"
"I don't know. Have you tried calling her?"
"She's not picking up. What the hell's been going on? I've been on a wild goose chase all day, and I come back."
"Wild goose chase?" repeated Strike, surreptitiously shifting his leg to keep the prosthesis upright. Bristow threw himself onto the seat opposite, breathing hard and squinting at Strike in the bright evening sun streaming in through the window behind him. "Somebody," he said furiously, "called my secretary up this morning, purporting to be a very important client of ours in Rye, who was requesting an urgent meeting. I travelled all the way there to find that he's out of the country, and nobody had called me at all. Would you mind," he added, raising a hand to shield his eyes, "pulling down that blind? I can't see a thing."
Strike tugged the cord, and the blind fell with a clatter, casting them both into a cool, faintly striped gloom.
"That's a very strange story," said Strike. "It's almost as though somebody wanted to lure you away from town."
Bristow did not reply. He was glaring at Strike, his chest heaving.
"I've had enough," he said abruptly. "I'm terminating this investigation. You can keep all the money I've given you. I've got to think of my mother."
Strike slid his mobile out of his pocket, pressed a couple of buttons, and laid it on his lap.
"Don't you even want to know what I found today in your mother's wardrobe?"
You went inside my mother's wardrobe?"
"Yeah. I wanted to have a look inside those brand new handbags Lula got the day she died."
Bristow began to stutter.
You...
"The bags have got detachable linings. Bizarre idea, isn't it? Hidden under the lining of the white bag was a will. Handwritten by Lula on your mother's blue notepaper, and witnessed by Rochelle on Ifade. I've given it to the police."
Bristow's mouth fell open. For several seconds he seemed unable to speak. Finally he whispered,
"But what did it say?"
"That she was leaving everything, her entire estate, to her brother, Lieutenant Jonah Aguman of the Royal Engineers."
"Jonah... who?"
"Go and look on the computer monitor outside. You'll find a picture there."
Bristow got up and moved like a sleepwalker towards the computer in the next room. Strike watched the screen illuminate as Bristow shifted the mouse. Aguman's handsome face shone out of the monitor, with his sardonic smile, pristine in his dress uniform.
"Oh, my God," said Bristow.
He returned to Strike and lowered himself back into the chair, gaping at the detective.
I can't believe it."
"That's the man who was on the CCTV footage," said Strike, "running away from the scene the night that Lula died. He was staying in Clerkenwell with his widowed mother while he was on leave. That's why he was hot-footing it along Theobald's Road 20 minutes later. He was heading home."
Bristow drew breath in a loud gasp.
"They all said I was deluded,"
he almost shouted.
"But I wasn't bloody deluded at all."
"No, John, you weren't deluded," said Strike. "Not deluded. More like batshit insane."
Through the shaded window came the sounds of London, alive at all hours, rumbling and growling, part man, part machine. There was no noise inside the room but Bristow's ragged breathing.
"Excuse me," he said, ludicrously polite. "What did you call me?"
Strike smiled.
"I said you're batshit insane.
You killed your sister, got away with it, and then asked me to reinvestigate her death.
You cannot be serious.
Oh, yes, I can. It's been obvious to me from the start that the person who benefits most from Lula's death is you, John. 10 million quid, once your mother gives up the ghost. Not to be sniffed at, is it? Especially as I don't think you've got much more than your salary, however much you bang on about your trust fund. Albrecht's shares are hardly worth the paper they're written on these days, are they? Bristow gaped at him for several long moments. Then, sitting up a little straighter, he glanced at the camp bed propped in the corner.
Coming from a virtual downer now who sleeps in his office, I find that a laughable assertion.
Bristow's voice was calm and derisory, but his breathing was abnormally fast. I know you've got much more money than I have, said Strike, but as you rightly point out, that's not saying much. And I will say for myself that I haven't yet stooped to embezzling from clients. How much of Conway Oates's money did you steal before Tony realized what you were up to?
Oh, I'm an embezzler too, am I?
Said Bristow, with an artificial laugh. Yeah, I think so, said Strike. Not that it matters to me. I don't care whether you killed Lula because you needed to replace the money you'd nicked, or because you wanted her millions, or because you hated her guts. The jury will want to know, though. They're always suckers for motive. Bristow's knee had begun jiggling up and down again.
You're unhinged, he said, with another forced laugh. You found a will in which she leaves everything not to me, but to that man.
He pointed towards the outer room, where he had viewed Jonah's picture.
You tell me that it was that same man who was walking towards Lula's flat on camera the night she fell to her death, and who was seen sprinting back past the camera 10 minutes later, and yet you accuse me. Me!
John, you knew before you ever came to see me that it was Jonah on that CCTV footage. Rochelle told you. She was there in Vashti when Lula called Jonah and arranged to meet him that night, and she witnessed a will leaving him everything. She came to you, told you everything, and started blackmailing you. She wanted money for a flat and some expensive clothes, and in return, she promised to keep her mouth shut about the fact that you weren't Lula's heir. Rochelle didn't realize you were the killer. She thought Jonah pushed Lula out of the window, and she was bitter enough after seeing a will in which she didn't feature and being dumped in that shop on the last day of Lula's life not to care about the killer walking free as long as she got the money.
This is utter rubbish. You're out of your mind.
You put every obstacle you could in the way of me finding Rochelle, Strike went on, as though he had not heard Bristow. You pretended you didn't know her name or where she lived. You acted incredulous that I thought she might be useful to the inquiry, and you took photos off Lula's laptop so that I couldn't see what she looked like. True, she could have pointed me directly to the man you were trying to frame for murder, but on the other hand, she knew that there was a will that would deprive you of your inheritance, and your number one objective was to keep that will quiet while you tried to find and destroy it. Bit of a joke, really, it being in your mother's wardrobe all along. But even if you destroyed it, John, what then? For all you knew, Jonah himself knew that he was Lula's heir. And there was another witness to the fact that there was a will, though you didn't know it. Bryony Radford, the makeup artist. Strike saw Bristow's tongue flick around his mouth, moistening his lips. He could feel the lawyer's fear. Bryony doesn't want to admit that she went snooping through Lula's things, but she saw that will at Lula's place before Lula had time to hide it. Bryony's dyslexic, though. She thought Jonah said John. She tied that in with Kiara saying that Lula was leaving her brother everything, and concluded that she needn't tell anybody what she'd read on the sly, because you were getting the money anyway. You've had the luck of the devil at times, John. But I can see how, to a twisted mind like yours, the best solution to your predicament was to fit Jonah up for murder. If he was doing life, it wouldn't matter whether or not the will ever surfaced, or whether he or anyone else knew about it, because the money would come to you in any case.
Ridiculous, said Bristow breathlessly. You ought to give up detecting and try fantasy writing, Strike. You haven't got a shred of proof for anything you're saying.
Yes, I have. Strike cut across him, and Bristow stopped talking immediately, his pallor visible through the gloom. The CCTV footage. That footage shows Jonah Aguman running from the scene of the killing, as you've just acknowledged. There was another man caught on camera.
So he had an accomplice, a lookout.
I wonder what defending counsel would say is wrong with you, John, asked Strike softly. Narcissism? Some kind of god complex? You think you're completely untouchable, don't you? A genius who makes the rest of us look like chimps. The second man running from the scene wasn't Jonah's accomplice, or his lookout, or a car thief. He wasn't even black. He was a white man in black gloves. He was you.
No,
said Bristow. The one word throbbed with panic, but then, with an almost visible effort, he hitched a contemptuous smile back onto his face. How can it be me? I was in Chelsea with my mother. She told you so. Tony saw me there. I was in Chelsea. Your mother is a Valium-addicted invalid who was asleep most of that day. You didn't get back to Chelsea until after you'd killed Lula. I think you went into your mother's room in the small hours, reset her clock, and then woke her up, pretending it was dinner time. You think you're a criminal genius, John, but that's been done a million times before, though rarely with such an easy mark. Your mother hardly knows what day it is, the amount of opiate she's got in her system.
I was in Chelsea all day, repeated Bristow, his knee jiggling up and down. All day, except for when I nipped into the office for files.
You took a hoodie and gloves out of the flat beneath Lula's. You're wearing them in the CCTV footage, said Strike, ignoring the interruption. And that was a big mistake. That hoodie was unique. There was only one of them in the world. It had been customised for D.B. Mack by Guy Sommet. It could only have come out of the flat beneath Lula's, so we know that's where you'd been.
You have absolutely no proof, said Bristow. I am waiting for proof.
Of course you are, said Strike simply. An innocent man wouldn't be sitting here listening to me. He'd have stormed out by now. But don't worry. I've got proof.
You can't have, said Bristow hoarsely.
Motive, means, and opportunity, John. You had the lot. Let's start at the beginning. You don't deny that you went to Lula's first thing in the morning?
No, of course not.
Because people saw you there. But I don't think Lula ever gave you the contract with Sommet that you used to get upstairs to see her. I think you'd swiped that at some point previously. Wilson waved you up, and minutes later, you were having a shouting match with Lula on her doorstep. You couldn't pretend that didn't happen, because the cleaner overheard it. Fortunately for you, Lexinka's English is so bad that she confirmed your version of the row, that you were furious that Lula had reunited with her freeloading druggy boyfriend. But I think that row was really about Lula's refusal to give you money. All her sharper friends have told me you had quite the reputation for coveting her fortune. But you must have been particularly desperate for a handout that day, to force your way in and start shouting like that. Had Tony noticed a lack of funds in Conway Oates's account? Did you need to replace it urgently?
Baseless speculation, said Bristow,
his knee still jerking up and down. We'll see whether it's baseless or not once we get to court, said Strike.
I've never denied that Lula and I argued.
After she refused to hand over a check and slammed the door in your face, you went back down the stairs and there was the door to flat two standing open. Wilson and the alarm repairman were busy looking at the keypad, and Lexinka was somewhere in there by then,
Maybe hoovering, because that would have helped mask the noise of you creeping into the hall behind the two men. It wasn't that much of a risk, really. If they'd turned and seen you, you could have pretended you'd come in to thank Wilson for letting you up. You crossed the hall while they were busy with the alarm fuse box, and you hid somewhere in that big flat. There's loads of space. Empty cupboards, under the bed. Bristow was shaking his head in silent denial. Strike continued in the same matter-of-fact tone. You must have heard Wilson telling Lexinka to set the alarm to 1966. Finally, Lexinka, Wilson, and the security bell guy left, and you had sole possession of the flat. Unfortunately for you, however, Lula had now left the building, so you couldn't go back upstairs and try and bully her into coughing up.
Total fantasy, said the lawyer. I never set foot in flat two in my life. I left Lula's and went into the office to pick up files.
From Allison. Isn't that what you said the first time we went through your movements that day? Asked Strike.
Patches of pink blossomed again up Bristow's stringy neck. After a small hesitation, he cleared his throat and said,
I don't remember whether. I just know that I was very quick. I wanted to get back to my mother.
What effect do you think it's going to have in court, John, when Allison takes the stand and tells the jury how you asked her to lie for you? You played the devastated bereaved brother in front of her, and then asked her out to dinner, and the poor bitch was so delighted to have a chance to look like a desirable female in front of Tony that she agreed. A couple of dates later, you persuaded her to say she saw you at the office on the morning before Lula died. She thought you were just over-anxious and paranoid, didn't she? She believed that you already had a cast-iron alibi from her adored Tony later in the day. She didn't think it mattered if she told a little white lie to calm you down. But Allison wasn't there that day, John, to give you any files. Cyprian sent her off to Oxford the moment she got to work to look for Tony. You became a bit nervous after Rochelle's funeral when you realized I knew all about that, didn't you?
Allison isn't very bright, said Bristow slowly, his hands washing themselves in dumb show and his knee jiggling up and down. She must have confused the days. She clearly misunderstood me. I never asked her to say she saw me at the office. It's her word against mine. Maybe she's trying to revenge herself on me, because we've split up.
Strike laughed. Oh, you're definitely dumped, John. After my assistant rang you this morning to lure you to Rye.
Your assistant?
Yeah, of course. I didn't want you around while I searched your mother's flat, did I? Allison helped us out with the name of the client. I rang her, you see, and told her everything, including the fact that I've got proof that Tony's sleeping with Ursula May and that you're about to be arrested for murder. That seemed to convince her that she ought to look for a new boyfriend and a new job. I hope she's gone to her mother's place in Sussex. That's what I told her to do. You've been keeping Allison close because you thought she was your fail-safe alibi, and because she's a conduit to knowing what Tony, whom you fear, is thinking. But lately, I've been getting worried that she might outlive her usefulness to you, and fall off something high. Bristow tried for another scathing laugh, but the sound was artificial and hollow. So it turns out that nobody saw you nip into your office for files that morning, continued Strike. You were still hiding out in the middle flat at number 18, Kentigern Gardens.
I wasn't there. I was in Chelsea, at my mother's, said Bristow.
I don't think you were planning to murder Lula at that point, Strike continued regardless. You probably just had some idea of waylaying her again when she came back. Nobody was expecting you at the office that day because you were supposed to be working from home to keep your sick mother company. There was a full fridge and you knew how to get in and out without setting off the alarm. You had a clear view of the street, so if D.B. Mack and entourage were to appear, you had plenty of time to get out of there
and walked downstairs with some cock-and-bull story about having been waiting for your sister at her place. The only remote risk was the possibility of deliveries into the flat. But that massive vase of roses arrived without anyone noticing you hiding in there, didn't it? I expect the idea of the murder started to germinate then. All those hours you were alone, in all that luxury. Did you start to imagine how wonderful it would be if Lula, who you were sure was intestate, died? You must have known your sick mother would be a much softer touch, especially once you were her only remaining child. And that in itself must have felt great, John, didn't it? The idea of being the only child at long last, and never losing out again to a better-looking, more lovable sibling. Even in the thickening gloom, he could see Bristow's jutting teeth and the intense stare of the weak eyes. No matter how much you fawned over your mother and played the devoted son, you've never come first with her, have you? She always loved Charlie most, didn't she? Everyone did, even Uncle Tony. And the moment Charlie had gone, when you might have expected to be the centre of attention at last, what happens? Lula arrives, and everyone starts worrying about Lula, looking after Lula, adoring Lula. Your mother hasn't even got a picture of you by her deathbed. Just Charlie and Lula. Just the two she loved. Fuck you, snarled Bristow. Fuck you, Strike. What do you know about anything with your whore of a mother? What was it she died of? The clap? Nice, said Strike, appreciatively. I was going to ask you whether you looked into my personal life when you were trying to find some patsy to manipulate. I bet you thought I'd be particularly sympathetic to poor, bereaved John Bristow, didn't you? What with my own mother having died young, in suspicious circumstances. You thought you'd be able to play me like a fucking violin. But never mind, John. If your defence team can't find a personality disorder for you, I'll expect they'll argue that your upbringing's to blame. Unloved, neglected, overshadowed. Always felt hard done by, haven't you? I noticed it the first day I met you, when you burst into those moving tears at the memory of Lula being carried up the drive into your home, into your life. Your parents hadn't even taken you with them to get her, had they? They left you at home like a pet dog. The son who wasn't enough for them once Charlie had died. The son who was about to come a poor second all over again.
I don't have to listen to this, whispered Bristow.
You're free to leave, said Strike, watching the place where he could no longer make out eyes in the deepening shadows behind Bristow's glasses. Why not leave? But the lawyer merely sat there, one knee still jiggling up and down, his hands sliding over each other, waiting to hear Strike's proof. Was it easier the second time? The detective asked quietly. Was it easier killing Lula than killing Charlie? He saw the pale teeth, bared as Bristow opened his mouth, but no sound came out. Tony knows you did it, doesn't he? All that bullshit about the hard, cruel things he said after Charlie died. Tony was there. He saw you cycling away from the place where you pushed Charlie over. Did you dare him to ride close to the edge? I knew Charlie. He couldn't resist a dare. Tony saw Charlie dead at the bottom of that quarry, and he told your parents that he thought you'd done it, didn't he? That's why your father hit him. That's why your mother fainted. That's why Tony was thrown out of the house after Charlie died. Not because Tony said that your mother had raised delinquents, but because he told her she was raising a psychopath.
This is... No, croaked Bristow. No.
But Tony couldn't face a family scandal. He kept quiet. Panicked a bit when he heard they were adopting a little girl, though, didn't he? He called them and tried to stop it happening. He was right to be worried, wasn't he? I think you've always been a bit scared of Tony. What a fucking irony that he backed himself into a corner where he had to give you an alibi for Lula's murder.
Bristow said nothing at all. He was breathing very fast. Tony needed to pretend he was somewhere, anywhere, other than shacked up in a hotel with Cyprian May's wife that day, so he said he'd double back to London to go and visit his sick sister. Then he realised that both you and Lula were supposed to have been there at the same time. His niece was dead, so she couldn't contradict him. But he had no choice but to pretend he saw you through the study door and didn't talk to you, and you backed him up. Both of you lying through your teeth, wondering what the other one was up to, but too scared to question each other. I think Tony kept telling himself he'd wait until your mother died before he confronted you. Perhaps that's how he kept his conscience quiet. But he's still been worried enough to ask Alison to keep an eye on you. And meanwhile, you've been feeding me that bullshit about Lula hugging you and the touching reconciliation before she returned home.
I was there, said Bristow in a rasping whisper. I was in my mother's flat. If Tony wasn't there, that's his affair. You can't prove I wasn't.
I'm not in the business of proving negatives, John. All I'm saying is, you've now lost every alibi except your Valium-addled mother. But for the sake of argument, let's assume that while Lula's visiting your groggy mother, and Tony's off fucking Ursula in a hotel somewhere, you're still hiding out in flat two, and starting to think out a much more daring solution to your cash flow problem. You wait. At some point you put on the black leather gloves that have been left in the wardrobe for DB as a precaution against fingerprints. That looks fishy. Almost as though you're starting to contemplate violence. Finally, in the early afternoon, Lula comes back home, but unfortunately for you, as you no doubt saw through the peephole of the flat, she's with friends. And now, said Strike, his voice hardening, I think the case against you starts to become serious. A defence of manslaughter, it was an accident, we tussled a bit and she fell over the balcony, might have held water if you hadn't stayed downstairs all that time while you knew she had visitors. A man with nothing worse on his mind than bullying his sister into giving him a large cheque might, just might, wait until she was alone again. But you'd already tried that and it hadn't worked. So why not go up there when she was, perhaps, in a better mood? And have a go with the restraining presence of her friends in the next room. Maybe she'd have given you something just to get rid of you. Strike could almost feel the waves of fear and hatred emanating from the figure fading into the shadows across the desk. But instead, he said, you waited. You waited all that evening, having watched her leave the building. You must have been pretty tightly wound by then. You had time to formulate a rough plan. You'd been watching the street. You knew exactly who was in the building and who wasn't. You'd worked out that there might just be a means of getting clean away without anyone being the wiser. And let's not forget, you'd killed before. That makes a difference.
Bristow made a sharp movement, little more than a jerk. Strike tensed, but Bristow remained stationary. And Strike was acutely aware of the unattached prosthesis merely resting against his leg. You were watching out of the window and you saw Lula come home alone, but the paparazzi were still out there. You must have despaired at that point, did you? But then, miraculously, as though the universe really did want nothing more than to help John Bristow get what he wanted, they all left. I'm pretty sure that Lula's regular driver tipped him off. He's a man who's keen to forge good contacts with the press. So, now the street's empty. The moment has arrived. You pulled on DB's hoodie. Big mistake. But you must admit, with all the lucky breaks you got that night, something had to go wrong. And then, and I'm going to give you full marks for this, because it puzzled me for a long time. You took a few of those white roses out of their vase, didn't you? You wiped the ends dry, not quite as thoroughly as you should have done, but pretty well. And you carried them out of flat two, leaving the door ajar again, and climbed the stairs to your sister's flat. You didn't notice that you'd left a few little drops of water from the roses, by the way. Wilson slipped on them later. You got up to Lula's flat and you knocked. When she looked through the peephole, what did she see?
white roses. She'd been standing on her balcony with the windows wide open, watching and waiting for her long-lost brother to come down the street, but somehow he seems to have got in without her seeing him. In her excitement, she throws open the door, and you're in.
Bristow was completely still. Even his knee had stopped jiggling.
And you killed her. Just the same way you killed Charlie. Just the same way you later killed Rochelle. You pushed her hard and fast. Maybe you lifted her, but she was caught by surprise, wasn't she? Just like the others. You were yelling at her for not giving you money, for depriving you, just as you've always been deprived, haven't you, John, of your portion of parental love. She yelled at you that you wouldn't get a penny, even if you killed her. As you fought, and you forced her across her sitting room towards that balcony in the drop, she told you she had another brother, a real brother, and that he was on his way, and that she'd made a will in his favour. "It's too late, I've already done it," she screamed. And you called her a lying fucking bitch, and you threw her down into the street to her death.
Bristow was barely breathing.
I think you must have dropped the roses at her front door. You ran back out, picked them up, sprinted down the stairs and back into flat two, where you rammed them back into their vase. Fuck me, you were lucky. That vase got smashed accidentally by a copper, and those roses were the one clue to show that someone had been in that flat. You can't have replaced them the way the florist had arranged them, not when you knew you had minutes to get clear of that building. The next bit took nerve. I doubt you expected anyone to raise the alarm straight away, but Tansy Bastigui had been on the balcony below you. You heard her screaming and realized you had even less time to get out of there than you'd been counting on. Wilson ran out to the street to check Lula, and then, waiting at the door, staring through the peephole, you saw him run upstairs to the top floor. You reset the alarm, let yourself out of the flat, and edged down the stairwell. The Bastiguis are bellowing at each other in their own flat. You run downstairs, heard by Freddy Bastigui, though he had other preoccupations at the time. The lobby's empty. You run through it and out onto the street, where it's snowing thick and fast. And you ran, didn't you? Hoodie up, face covered, gloved hands pumping. And at the end of the street, you saw another man running. Running for his life, away from the corner where he'd just seen his sister fall to her death. You didn't know each other. I don't think you had a thought to spare for who he was, not then. You ran as fast as you could, in D.B. Mack's borrowed clothes, past the CCTV camera that caught you both on film, and off down Halliwell Street, where your luck caught up with you again, and there were no more cameras. I expect you chucked the hoodie and the gloves in a bin and grabbed a taxi, did you? The police never bothered looking for a suited white man who was out and about that night. You went home to your mother's, you made food for her. You changed the time on her clock and you woke her up. She's still convinced that the two of you were talking about Charlie. Nice touch, John. At the precise moment that Lula plunged to her death. You got away with it, John. You could have afforded to keep paying Rochelle for life. With your luck, Jonah Aguiman might even have died in Afghanistan. You've been getting your hopes up every time you've seen a picture of a black soldier in the paper, haven't you? But you didn't want to trust to luck. You're a twisted, arrogant fucker, and you thought you could arrange things better.
There was a long silence.
No proof,
said Bristow at last. It was so dark in the office now that he was barely more than a silhouette to Strike.
No proof at all.
I'm afraid you're wrong there, said Strike. The police should have got a warrant by now.
For what? Asked Bristow, and he finally felt confident enough to laugh.
To search the bins of London for a hoodie that you say was thrown away 3 months ago?
No.
To look in your mother's safe, of course.
Strike was wondering whether he could raise the blind quickly enough. He was a long way from a light switch, and the office was very dark, but he did not want to take his eyes off Bristow's shadowy figure. He was sure that this triple murderer would not have come unprepared. "I've given him a few combinations to try," Strike went on. "If they don't work, I suppose they'll have to call in an expert to open it. But if I were a betting man, I'd put my money on 030483. A rustle, the blur of a pale hand, and Bristow lunged. The knife point grazed Strike's chest as he slammed Bristow sideways. The lawyer slid off the desk, rolled over and attacked again, and this time Strike fell over backwards in his chair, with Bristow on top of him, trapped between the wall and the desk. Strike had one of Bristow's wrists, but he couldn't see where the knife was. All was darkness, and he threw a punch that hit Bristow hard under the chin, knocking his head back and sending his glasses flying. Strike punched again, and Bristow hit the wall. Strike tried to sit up, with Bristow's lower body pinning his agonizing half-leg to the ground, and a knife struck him hard in the upper arm. He felt it pierce the flesh, and the flow of warm blood, and the white-hot stinging pain. He saw Bristow raise his arm in dim silhouette against the faint window. Forcing himself up against the lawyer's weight, he deflected the second knife blow, and with an almighty effort managed to throw the lawyer off, and the prosthesis slid out of his trouser leg as he tried to pin Bristow down, with his hot blood spattering over everything, and no knowledge of where the knife was now. The desk was knocked over by Strike's wrestling weight, and then, as he knelt with his good knee on Bristow's thin chest, groping with his good hand to find the knife, light split his retinas in two, and a woman was screaming. Dazzled, Strike glimpsed the knife rising to his stomach. He seized the prosthetic leg beside him and brought it down like a club on Bristow's face, once, twice. "Stop, Cormoran! Stop! You're going to kill him!" Strike rolled off Bristow, who was no longer moving, dropped the prosthetic leg and lay on his back, clutching his bleeding arm beside the overturned desk. "I thought," he panted, unable to see Robin, "I told you to go home." But she was already on the telephone.
"Police and ambulance!"
"And get a taxi," Strike croaked from the floor, his throat dry from so much talking. "I'm not travelling to hospital with this piece of shit." He stretched out an arm and retrieved the mobile that lay several feet away. The face was smashed, but it was still recording. Epilogue. Nihil est ab omni parte beatum. Nothing is an unmixed blessing. Horace, Odes, Book 2. 10 days later. The British Army requires of its soldiers a subjugation of individual needs and ties that is almost incomprehensible to the civilian mind. It recognizes virtually no claims higher than its own, and the unpredictable crises of human life, births and deaths, weddings, divorces and illness, generally cause no more deviation to the military's plans than pebbles pinging on the underbelly of a tank. Nevertheless, there are exceptional circumstances, and it was due to one such circumstance that Lieutenant Jonah Agyeman's second tour of duty in Afghanistan was cut short. His presence in Britain was urgently required by the Metropolitan Police, and while the Army does not generally rate the claims of the Met higher than its own, in this case, it was prepared to be helpful. The circumstances surrounding the death of Agyeman's sister were garnering international attention, and a media storm around a hitherto obscure sapper was deemed unhelpful both to the individual and the army he served. And so Jonah was put on a plane back to Britain, where the army did its impressive best to shield him from the ravenous press. It was assumed by considerable numbers of the news-reading public that Lieutenant Agyeman would be delighted, firstly to be home from combat, and secondly to have returned in the expectation of wealth beyond his wildest imaginings. However, the young soldier that Cormoran Strike met in the Tottenham pub one lunchtime, 10 days after the arrest of his sister's murderer, was almost truculent, and seemed still to be in a state of shock. The two men had, for different periods of time, lived the same life and risked the same death. It was a bond that no civilian could understand, and for half an hour they talked about nothing but the army.
"You were a suit, yeah?" Agumon said. "Trust a suit to fuck up my whole life."
Strike smiled. He saw no ingratitude in Agumon, even though the stitches in his arm pulled painfully every time he raised his pint.
"My mother wants me to come out," said the soldier. "She keeps saying that'll be one good thing to come out of this mess."
It was the first oblique reference to the reason they were here, and that Jonah was not where he belonged, with his regiment, in the life he had chosen. Then, quite suddenly, he began to talk, as though he had been waiting for Strike for months.
"She never knew my dad had another kid. He never told her. He was never even sure that Marlene woman was telling the truth about being pregnant. Right before he died, when he knew he had days left, he told me, 'Don't upset your mother,' he said. 'I'm telling you this because I'm dying, and I don't know whether you've got a half-brother or sister out there.' He said the mother had been white, and that she disappeared. She might have aborted it. Fuck me, if you'd know my dad. Never missed a Sunday at church. Took communion on his deathbed. I'd never expected anything like that, never. I was never even going to say anything to her about Dad and this woman. But then, out of the blue, I get this phone call. Thank Christ I was there, on leave.
Only Lula?" He said her name tentatively, as though he was not sure whether he had the right to it. "Said she'd have hung up if it had been my mum. She said she didn't want to hurt anyone. She sounded all right."
"I think she was," said Strike.
"Yeah, but fuck me, it was weird. Would you believe it if some supermodel called you up and told you she was your sister?" Strike thought of his own bizarre family history.
"Probably," he said.
"Yeah, well, I suppose. Why would she lie? That's what I thought anyway. So I gave her my mobile number and we talked a few times, when she could hook up with her friend Rochelle. She had it all figured out so the press wouldn't find out. Suited me. I didn't want my mother upset."
Agumon had pulled out a packet of Lambert and Butler cigarettes and was turning the box nervously in his fingers. They would have been bought cheap, Strike thought, with a small pang of remembrance at the Naffy.
"So she phones me up the day before it happened," Jonah continued, "and she was begging me to come over. I'd already told her I couldn't meet her that leave. Man, the situation was doing me head in. My sister, the supermodel. Mum was worried about me leaving for Helmand. I couldn't spring it on her that Dad had had another kid, not then. So I told Lula I couldn't see her. She begged me to meet her before I left. She sounded upset. I said maybe I could get out later, you know, after Mum was in bed. I'd tell her I was going out for a quick drink with a mate or something. She told me to come really late, like at 1:30. So," said Jonah, scratching the back of his neck uncomfortably, "I went. I was on the corner of her road, and I saw it happen." He wiped his hand across his mouth. "I ran. I just ran. I didn't know what the hell to think. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to have to explain anything to anyone. I knew she'd had mental problems, and I remembered how upset she'd been on the phone, and I thought, did she lure me here to see her jump? I couldn't sleep. I was glad to leave, to tell you the truth, to get away from all the fucking news coverage." The pub buzzed around them, crowded with lunchtime customers. "I think the reason she wanted to meet you so badly was because of what her mother had just told her," Strike said. "Lady Bristow had taken a lot of Valium. I'm guessing she wanted to make the girl feel too bad to leave her, so she told Lula what Tony had said about John all those years before, that he pushed his younger brother Charlie into that quarry and killed him. That's why Lula was in such a state when she left her mother's flat, and that's why she kept trying to call her uncle and find out whether there was any truth in the story. And I think she was desperate to see you because she wanted someone, anyone, she could love and trust. Her mother was difficult and dying. She hated her uncle, and she'd just been told her adopted brother was a killer. She must have been desperate. And I think she was scared. The day before she died,
Bristow would try to force her to give him money. She must have been wondering what he'd do next. The pub clattered and rang with talk and clinking glasses, but Jonah's voice sounded clearly over all of it. "I'm glad you broke the bastard's jaw."
"And his nose," said Strike cheerfully.
"It's lucky he'd stuck a knife in me, or I might not have got off with reasonable force."
"He came armed," said Jonah thoughtfully.
"Course he did," said Strike.
"I'd had my secretary tip him off at Rochelle's funeral that I was getting death threats from a nutter who wanted to slit me open. That planted the seed in his head. He thought, if it came to it, he'd try and pass off my death as the work of poor old Brian Mathers. Then, presumably, he'd have gone home, doctored his mother's clock, and tried to pull the same trick all over again. He's not sane. Which isn't to say he's not a clever fucker." There seemed little more to say. As they left the pub, Agumon, who had bought the drinks with nervous insistence, made what might have been a tentative offer of money to Strike, whose impecunious existence had padded out much of the media coverage. Strike cut the offer short, but he was not offended. He could see that the young sapper was struggling to deal with the idea of his enormous new wealth, that he was buckling under the responsibility of it, the demands it made, the appeals it attracted, the decisions it entailed, that he was much more overawed than glad. There was also, of course, the horrible and ever-present knowledge of how his millions had come to him. Strike guessed that Jonah Agumon's thoughts were flitting wildly between his comrades back in Afghanistan, visions of sports cars, and of his half-sister lying dead in the snow. Who was more conscious than the soldier of capricious fortune, of the random roll of the dice?
"He won't get off, will he?" asked Agumon suddenly, as they were about to part.
"No, of course not," said Strike. "The papers haven't got it yet, but the police found Rochelle's mobile phone in his mother's safe. He didn't dare get rid of it. He'd reset the code of the safe so that no one could get in but him. 030483. Easter Sunday, 1983. The day he killed my mate Charlie." It was Robin's last day. Strike had invited her to come with him to meet Jonah Agumon, whom she had done so much to find, but she had refused. Strike had the feeling that she was deliberately withdrawing from the case, from the work, from him. He had an appointment at the amputee centre at Queen Mary's Hospital that afternoon. She would be gone by the time he returned from Roehampton. Matthew was taking her to Yorkshire for the weekend. As Strike limped back to the office through the continuing chaos of the building work, he wondered whether he would ever see his temporary secretary again after today, and doubted it. Not so very long ago, the impermanence of their arrangement had been the only thing that reconciled him to her presence, but now he knew that he would miss her. She had come with him in the taxi to the hospital and wrapped her trench coat around his bleeding arm. The explosion of publicity around Bristow's arrest had done Strike's business no harm at all. He might even genuinely need a secretary before long. And indeed, as he made his way painfully up the stairs to his office, he heard Robin's voice on the telephone. "An appointment for Tuesday. I'm afraid because Mr. Strike's busy all day Monday." "Yes, absolutely. I'll put you down for 11 o'clock then." "Yes, thank you, goodbye." She swung around in a swivel chair as Strike entered. "What was Jonah like?" she demanded.
"Nice guy," said Strike, lowering himself into the collapsed sofa. "Situation's doing his head in, but the alternative was Bristow winding up with 10 mil, so he'll have to cope."
"Three prospective clients phoned while you were out," she said. "But I'm a bit worried about that last one. He could be another journalist. He was much more interested in discussing you than his own problem." There had been quite a few such calls. The press had seized with glee upon a story that had angles aplenty and everything they loved best. Strike himself had featured heavily in the coverage. The photograph they had used most, and he was glad of it, was 10 years old and had been taken while he was still a redcap. But they had also dug out the picture of the rock star, his wife, and the super groupie.
There had been plenty written about police incompetence. Carver had been snapped hurrying down the street, his jacket flying, the sweat patches just visible on his shirt. But Wardle, handsome Wardle, who had helped Strike bring Bristow in, had so far been treated with indulgence, especially by female journalists. Mostly, however, the news media had feasted all over again on the corpse of Lula Landry. Every version of the story sparkling with pictures of the dead model's flawless face and her lithe and sculpted body. Robin was talking. Strike had not been listening, his attention diverted by the throbbing in his arm and leg. A note of all the files in your diary, because you'll need someone now, you know. You're not going to be able to take care of all this on your own.
No, he agreed, struggling to his feet. He had intended to do this later, at the moment of her departure, but now was as good a moment as any, and it made an excuse to leave the sofa, which was extremely uncomfortable.
Listen, Robin, I haven't ever said a proper thank you.
Yes, you have, she said hurriedly, in the cab on the way to the hospital, and anyway there's no need. I've enjoyed it. I've loved it, actually. He was hobbling away into the inner office, and did not hear the catch in her voice. The present was hidden at the bottom of his kit bag. It was very badly wrapped.
Here, he said. This is for you. I couldn't have done it without you.
Oh, said Robin on a strangled note, and Strike was both touched and faintly alarmed to see tears spill down her cheeks.
You didn't have to.
Open it at home, he said, but too late. The package was literally coming apart in her hands. Something slithered, poison green, out of the split in the paper, onto the desk in front of her. She gasped.
You... Oh, my God, Cormoran!
She held up the dress she had tried on and loved in Vashti, and stared at him over the top of it, pink-faced, her eyes sparkling.
You can't afford this.
Yeah, I can, he said, leaning back against the partition wall, because it was marginally more comfortable than sitting on the sofa. Work's rolling in now. You've been incredible. Your new place is lucky to get you.
She was frantically mopping her eyes with the sleeves of her shirt. A sob and some incomprehensible words escaped her. She reached blindly for the tissues that she had bought from petty cash, in anticipation of more clients like Mrs. Hook, blew her nose, wiped her eyes and said, with the green dress lying limp and forgotten across her lap,
I don't want to go.
I can't afford you, Robin, he said flatly. It was not that he had not thought about it.
The night before he had lain awake on the camp bed, running calculations through his mind, trying to come up with an offer that might not seem insulting, beside the salary offered by the media consultancy. It was not possible. He could no longer defer payment on the largest of his loans. He was facing an increase in rent, and he needed to find somewhere to live other than his office. While his short-term prospects were immeasurably improved, the outlook remained uncertain.
I wouldn't expect you to match what they give me, Robin said thickly.
I couldn't come close, said Strike.
But she knew the state of Strike's finances almost as well as he did, and had already guessed at the most she could expect. The previous evening, when Matthew had found her in tears at the prospect of leaving, she had told him her estimate of Strike's best offer.
But he hasn't offered you anything at all, Matthew had said.
Has he?
No, but if he did...
Well, it would be up to you, Matthew had said stiffly. It'd be your choice. You'd have to decide.
She knew that Matthew did not want her to stay. He had sat for hours in casualty while they stitched Strike up, waiting to take Robin home. He had told her rather formally that she had done very well showing such initiative, but he had been distant and faintly disapproving ever since, especially when their friends clamoured for the inside details on everything that had appeared in the press. But surely Matthew would like Strike if only he met him. And Matthew himself had said that it was up to her what she did. Robin drew herself up a little, blew her nose again and told Strike, with calmness
slightly undermined by a small hiccup, the figure for which she would be happy to stay. It took Strike a few seconds to respond. He could just afford to pay what she had suggested. It was within £500 of what he himself had calculated that he could manage. She was, whichever way you looked at it, an asset that it would be impossible to replace at the price. There was only one tiny fly in the ointment.
"I could manage that," he said.
"Yeah. I could pay you that."
The telephone rang. Beaming at him, she answered it, and the delight in her voice was such that it sounded as though she had been eagerly anticipating the call for days.
"Oh, hello, Mr. Gillespie, how are you? Mr. Strike's just sent you a check. I put it in the post myself this morning. All the arrears, yes, and a little bit more. Oh, no, Mr. Strike's adamant he wants to pay off the loan." "Well, that's very kind of Mr. Rokeby, but Mr. Strike would rather pay. He's hopeful he'll be able to clear the full amount within the next few months."
An hour later, as Strike sat on a hard plastic chair at the amputee centre, his injured leg stretched in front of him, he reflected that if he had known Robin was going to stay, he would not have bought her the green dress. The gift would not, he was sure, find favour with Matthew, especially once he had seen her in it and heard that she had previously modelled it for Strike. With a sigh, he reached for a copy of Private Eye lying on the table beside him. When the consultant first called him, Strike did not respond. He was immersed in the page headed Landry Balls, crammed with examples of journalistic excess relating to the case that he and Robin had solved. So many columnists had mentioned Cain and Abel that the magazine had run a special feature.
"Mr. Strick!" shouted the consultant for the second time. "Mr. Cameron Strick!"
He looked up, grinning.
"Strike," he said clearly. "My name's Cormoran Strike."
"Oh, I do apologise. This way."
As Strike limped after the doctor, a phrase floated up out of his subconscious, a phrase he had read long before he had seen his first dead body, or marvelled at a waterfall in an African mountainside, or watched the face of a killer collapsing as he realised he was caught. "I am become a name." "Onto the table, please, and take off the prosthesis." Where had it come from, that phrase? Strike lay back on the table and frowned up at the ceiling, ignoring the consultant now bending over the remainder of his leg, muttering as he stared and gently prodded. It took minutes to dredge up the lines Strike had learned so long ago. "I cannot rest from travel. I will drink life to the lees. All times I have enjoyed greatly, have suffered greatly, both with those that love me and alone. On shore, and when through scudding drifts the rainy Hyades vexed the dim sea, I am become a name." You've been listening to The Cuckoo's Calling by Robert Galbraith, read by Robert Glenister. Text copyright Robert Galbraith, 2013. Production copyright Ashet Digital, 2013. This has been an Ashet Digital production.
The Cuckoo's Calling is also available in print and as an ebook from Mulholland Books, a division of Ashet Book Group. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher is unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.